Welcome to the Free School University program on Occupy Boston Radio, educational programming by and for the 99%. I'm David Knutinen, your host. Tonight, we are going to be broadcasting for you a program that originally aired on April 18, 2012. On that show, we were talking with activist Mike Prokosh about the military budget. We're in the planning stages of some upcoming shows on fiscal policy and the federal budget at FSU, and we thought re-airing this show would be a good way of leading into that topic, so I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. I'm David Knutinen, your host, and tonight's radio guest is activist Mike Prokosh. Mike is a longtime activist for peace and justice and one of the main organizers behind the 25% Coalition, which seeks to build support for cutting the U.S. military budget by 25% and investing those funds instead in building and sustaining our communities. So welcome to the show, Mike.
It's great to be on the air.
So, Mike, I wanted to start, maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about sort of how big the military budget really is. Is it true that the U.S. military budget is larger than all the rest of the countries of the world combined? That's a number I often hear.
It's not quite. It's about 42% of total global military spending, but that's an awful lot of money. The United States last year spent $783 billion. So for comparison, the Massachusetts state budget is about $30 billion. So,
wait,
you know,
can I have those numbers again? So, I kind of went over my head.
$780, I mean, the numbers, when they get that big, don't mean a lot, yeah. But $783 billion on the base Pentagon budget, so that's routine weapons purchases, foreign military bases, doesn't include things like many nuclear programs, doesn't include veterans support and medical care. Doesn't include interest on past wars, doesn't include Homeland Security or the black budget, the hidden intelligence budget. So actually, some have estimated that total U.S. military spending is more like $1 trillion a
wow.
year. And in comparison, if you look at Massachusetts's budget, which supports about 6 million people, citizens, services, jobs, infrastructure, all of that, that's only $30 billion.
Wow. That's a small fraction of the...
So it's less than a 20th, less than 1/25th of the total of total U.S. military spending. But that, you know, comparing it with the rest of the world is probably a more useful way to look at it. There's no country that comes anywhere close to what the United States spends on its military. The next biggest, China, isn't even spending $100 billion a year.
Wow.
So we're spending over seven times as much as what's supposed to be the next big emerging threat. There's no way. I mean, the only reason that there's any kind of competition going on there is that U.S. military strategy says we should be encircling China. China basically doesn't have the right to its own airspace, its own sea space. We have the right to overfly, to dominate everything but the land in China.
And that's just about every place else, it seems like. That's
The reason that the budget is so high is that we're basically occupying the world. We've got 95% of all the military bases on foreign soil in the world. You know, 19 out of 20 military bases that are on foreign soil in the world are U.S. military bases.
Most countries probably don't have foreign bases at all, do they?
That's right. We have 11 carrier battle groups. So these are basically floating airfields that are used to project power, bomb wherever
they want.
They're
really floating cities. I mean, they're huge.
They are. Yeah. No other country has more than one aircraft carrier.
Wow.
China just acquired its first. It was a mothballed Ukrainian aircraft carrier that was slated to be turned into a resort ship.
Wow.
So there's no challenge. There's no military rival. We're in an arms race with ourselves.
How do they justify? I mean, they justify it by telling us we need it for defense, but how come people don't see through that? It seems pretty transparent.
Well, they partly justify it by wars.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, if you're at war, then you got to rally around the flag. You got to defend the troops, even though the troops would be much better served, in our opinion, by bringing them home and not, keeping on their third deployment, their fourth deployment, getting shot up and, roughed up mentally. So, Wars are a very good way to keep generating terror, keep generating the need for more armament, more troops overseas, more power projection. Mm-hmm. And the other is to turn countries that aren't planning to attack us, like China, into aggressive threats that we have to counter before they gain the capability to do so.
Not to mention the whole Islamic world.
Yeah.
Right. So this kind of level of spending has to have an impact on domestic priorities. I mean, we're not, you know, money's not unlimited.
And particularly not now.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's a major cause of our network. And I also coordinate a national network called the New Priorities Network, mm-hmm. newprioritiesnetwork.org mm-hmm. on the web, which is groups, activists, economic justice activists, racial justice activists, peace activists around the country who are trying to move money from the Pentagon to their communities mm-hmm. for jobs and services mm-hmm. in their communities in a whole lot of different ways. There are a lot of different strategies at work here. We're trying a lot of different experiments in different places. And people are motivated by the outrageous budget cuts in state and local budgets.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the experiments that you're trying?
Well, people are passing resolutions at the city level mm-hmm. Saying, you know, hey, congressional delegation, White House, we need money mm-hmm. to plug the gaps. We don't want to close more libraries. We're tired of laying off teachers. Mm-hmm. Our parks are decaying. Public safety is in danger. Basic social services aren't being met. Mm-hmm. And the place we need you to look at and find the money is the Pentagon, is mm-hmm. unnecessary military spending. Mm-hmm. So by doing this, the strategy is to enlist your local elected officials who are being crunched in a lot of ways by mm-hmm. budget cuts, just as we are. These people
right.
did not run for office unless they are sort of extreme shrink government ideologues to downsize government.
Mm-hmm.
They ran because they want to further their political career, and you don't do that by cutting
programs
city budgets,
right.
Certainly not at the local level. People, the closer government is to people, the more they care about it. So people aren't so fond, so warm and fuzzy about the federal government, but they're
Getting awfully used to potholes and icy
yeah.
streets in this country.
Well, but they're not happy about it.
No.
People are much friendlier toward the state budget and the local budget, which delivers the most services of any level of government. It's almost entirely services, is the one that people are most engaged with, turn out to vote for. So people who run for a local elected office pretty much have to deliver the goods, and they're in a vice right now where they can't.
Well, it's very hard. I mean, local, at least, I don't know about how many states this is true, but I know it's certainly true in some, Massachusetts as an example. It's very hard for local governments to raise money directly because of caps that have been imposed on the state level on real estate tax, which is the main source of local government funds. So the state government has imposed taxes on limits on real estate taxes. So that leaves local governments very dependent on state and federal aid. So that
yes, and local governments are much more dependent upon federal aid than people realize. Most of it flows through the state, but it makes an enormous difference in a couple dozen programs,
mm-hmm.
From Head Start to community development block grants and community mm-hmm. Service block grants.
Even highway funds,
it,
right?
It really hurts local government when federal funds are cut, and that's what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the state is in pretty much the same bind. It cannot run an unbalanced budget
right.
in Massachusetts and almost every other state except, I think, Vermont. So
right. Although the state at least has no higher legislative authority that has told it can't raise taxes. So that's just that the legislature is itself afraid
yeah.
to do it.
Yeah. But the recession hurts. It hurts a lot. It
right.
cuts tax receipts. It lowers property values. It's hurting mm-hmm. state and local funding. Really, the only level of government that can bail us out at this point is the federal government, and it has done that in past recessions. It
mm-hmm.
has given more money to states and cities so that they can pull themselves out of the hole, get their local economies running, get tax receipts flowing back into their coffers,
mm-hmm.
And get out of the vicious cycle that we're in. And this time, that's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who are preventing that from happening are insisting that military spending must continue increasing, even though it has about doubled in the past 10 years, even though it's at record levels.
Almost doubled in the past 10 years.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does that include the budget for actually fighting the wars we're fighting, or is that
it does? But even without that, it's increased by more than half.
Uh-huh.
And the Pentagon is complaining right now about shortages. It's or at least not so much the Pentagon. Actually, the Pentagon is reconciled to budget cuts. The top brass are not speaking out against very modest cuts that are predicted for the future. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of hawks in Congress and military industry people who have an economic interest in more defense spending, who are saying this is going to devastate us. Mitt Romney, for example, as a presidential candidate, is saying if these cuts go through, the United States will have a Navy smaller than it has had since World War I.
Mm-hmm.
This is ignoring that one ship in today's Navy could blow that entire Navy out of the water.
Right.
One of the bigger ships, admittedly. One of the cruisers or aircraft carriers. So there's no comparison. They're complaining about the age of the aircraft, but the point is that they've had 10 years of almost doubled military spending, record military spending, to correct those problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the answer is not more money. The answer is forcing the Pentagon to make choices about how it spends its money, which they have not had to do over the past 10 years.
I mean, one of the biggest and most important wars this country ever fought, World War II, we were practically complete. We had almost no military establishment before that war. We geared up entirely for that war. Ever since then, we've never been able to scale down. Isn't that true? They just keep wanting more and more every year.
That's true, but there have been some constraints since that time, about 60, 70 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a group of people who are saying the sky's the limit. Mitt Romney is saying military spending should be 4% of gross domestic product.
So where is the demand for this? I mean, who benefits? I think you always have to ask, who benefits, right? Who benefits from this system? Why does the system sustain itself? Where's the power in this?
It's a lot like the privatization of the post office. So let's look at that. The post office over the last several decades has been increasingly nibbled away at by private mailers, mail houses, people who, if you've ever gotten a bulk mailing from a charity that's trying to raise money from you, or even from your utility company, these are companies that take a whole batch of mail, barcode it,
mm-hmm.
Pre-sort it so that there's less work that the post office has to do,
mm-hmm.
and deliver it basically pre-bundled to postal facilities.
Mm-hmm.
The post office invested billions of dollars in making that possible,
mm-hmm.
in setting up optical character recognition, barcodes, and pre-sorting to make it possible to basically contract out the work, to privatize postal work. And they have managed to downsize the postal workforce by a great deal during that time.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, although it's not a problem for the managers of the post office, just for the folks who work for it, that the bigger the private mail house industry, the bigger the built-in lobby for further privatization, lower, more discount rates for pre-sorting work and so forth. So what you're doing is to create a built-in lobby for privatizing your system.
Mm-hmm.
And under the past several presidencies, the same thing has been happening. The Navy in particular has been pushing to privatize everything that every one of its facilities that it can get its hands on, to contract out the work, to take, for example, a submarine listening post in Machias, Maine, mm-hmm. way up down east, out of civil service and give it to a contractor and let them run that facility, even though the people who are running it are doing a very good job. Basically, more famous examples are the privatization of a lot of the war functions in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
Setting up building camps, work that used to be done by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, providing meals, carting fuel around. All those functions used to be done by military personnel, mm-hmm. and now they're being done by private contractors, providing security to State Department personnel. All of that has created this enormous built-in lobby for more privatization. And the same thing obviously is true for weapons manufacturing going back to World War II.
Right. But I mean, I've never really understood where the Army benefits by that system, or the Navy in privatizing those bases. How does that, I mean, some collection of office, body of officers is making the decision to do that. And why are they doing it? How does it benefit them? I mean, it seems like it just takes more out of it. It's not going to, is it really cheaper? Does it really lower their budget line? Because these contractors don't work for nickels.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, the Pentagon is now spending more money on contracted military, contracted personnel who are doing essentially military jobs, than it is on its own civilian and enlisted personnel total, and officer corps. So, in other words, the Pentagon's spending more money on private contractors than it is on its own workforce, civilian and in the services. It's possible that it is also employing more private contractors than it is its own personnel, but its record keeping is so bad that it's impossible to figure that out. Mm-hmm. No, it's not cheaper. What you're doing is taking the good benefits, healthcare and so forth, that military personnel get, taking that money and instead of people getting good benefits, you're lining the pockets of a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I think that fundamentally, it's a civilian initiative. I don't think it's an. I mean, at that level, the Pentagon doesn't make its own decisions. That's set by the White House, basically, in Congress. So this whole initiative is part of the push for private. It's one and the same as the push for privatization of all other government functions that's going on in Washington, in state capitals, and even in some cities. I think that there may be some benefit to military officers, top brass. Certainly that's true for weapons manufacturing. So the revolving door there is pretty well known.
Yeah.
When you retire from the Pentagon, if you've got a desk job in the Pentagon, you've been dealing with weapons procurement, you get hired by McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, General Electric, and basically you go to work as a lobbyist. You go back to the Pentagon and lobby people who used to be your subordinates, used to salute you and say yes, sir, whenever you wanted, when you were walked into the room, and you urge them to buy more from your company. And when I was doing El Salvador solidarity work, the joke in El Salvador was that the promotion order in the Salvadoran Army was lieutenant, captain, major, colonel, general, millionaire.
Yeah.
And now that's true for the United States as well.
Uh-huh.
These people are earning a lot more than they did in the services. They can look forward to it.
Uh-huh.
And they are already half embedded in it when they're doing their desk jobs in the Pentagon.
So it's really just a back, I scratch your back, you scratch mine type of thing. And it's...
Yes. Now, the question is that also developing for people like Halliburton or XE, the former Blackwater, mercenary company and so forth? Hard to imagine that it's not. Mm-hmm. Hard to imagine that they don't have the system wired to push them more contracts because they have a major interest in doing it. So that's one way that this system perpetuates itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's enormously destructive to you and me because we would do much better if that money were being spent on jobs and services in our communities.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the kind of relationships, mutual back-scratching relationships, is that the military contractors, weapons manufacturers, and others get the contracts, and the people in the Pentagon can look forward to getting the jobs and the high pay.
Mm-hmm.
But the inventor of the term military-industrial complex was Dwight Eisenhower,
right,
in his farewell speech to Congress in 1960. And actually, he originally wanted to say military-industrial-congressional complex, and apparently his speechwriter talked him out of doing that since he was talking to Congress and didn't want to kick him on the shins on the way out the door. But if you want to see the whole Iron Triangle, the whole system that keeps military money flowing, Congress has to be a part of the picture because Congress actually appropriates the funds. And even when the Pentagon wants to cut a military program, wants to cut a weapon system, Congress often stuffs it back into the budget. over the Pentagon's advice. So they are even more gung-ho about funding every last weapon system, every last boondoggle than the Pentagon is.
Well, every weapon system is being developed in some congressman's district, right?
Right. The industrial system has been very careful to distribute the work around the country and build in a lobby across the country in every
Gingrich
state.
Had more than his fair share.
Well, yeah. And actually, the South has a tremendous amount of it. Basically, the South didn't recover from its post-Civil War depression until World War II, until massive investment and the TVA and other sort of Depression-era works projects. And so the South is, in addition to the famous sort of, military culture dating from the Confederacy or before, it's got a military-industrial culture that is really tied into its power structure and its economic structure. And, of course, Gingrich got more than his share, and so do many other Southern representatives and senators.
The other aspect of this increasing privatization is that there's a lot less accountability, isn't there? I mean, it's... You were talking about replacing civil service jobs in Maine with some private contractor who you don't have the same scrutiny over that contractor's payroll and their hires and who they bring in and who they have doing the work.
That may be, and if it's true, then it's a very, very low level of scrutiny because the Pentagon isn't exactly transparent. The Pentagon has not passed an audit in the last 20 years or more, if it has ever passed one. It does not know how much money it is spending where. There's just so much money flowing and so little interest in tracking it that, Congress keeps wagging its finger and saying, we're going to cut you off, and they never do, and the Pentagon keeps not coming up with a budget, an audit, year after year. So not only is it spending unfathomable amounts of money far in excess of anything anyone else in the world is spending, but it can't track how much it's spending.
I'm going to break here just for a little station ID, just to remind people that you are listening to the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, OBR.FM on your internet browser. Also, I'd like everybody to keep in mind that Occupy Boston Radio needs your support. Go to obr.fm and click on the button that says Donate. Your donation will make sure we have equipment to broadcast on and studio space to broadcast from. Don't let the voice of the 99% go silent. Support OBR today. So, Mike, I'm trying to think what else I wanted to ask you about. I mean, I guess one question is... The 25% coalition is talking about cutting 25% from the military budget. Why that number?
Well, it comes from Barney Frank, Representative Barney Frank, who about 3 years ago, out of the blue, came out with a statement that said, roughly, if we don't cut at least 25% of military spending and redirect that money to domestic uses, we'll never be able to adequately fund them. Barney is not the first person, by far, who is called for cutting military spending. The tradition goes back, actually, to Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, so it goes back about 100 years. But more recently, Martin Luther King, 45 years ago, issued an amazing statement in the speech where he came out against the war in Vietnam at Riverside Church, and said... Basically, the same thing. The war on poverty is being sapped dry by the spending on the war in Vietnam, and the dreams are all going up in smoke. And actually, black political leaders and activists have carried the banner forward. The Black Congressional Caucus tried to cut the military budget in the early 70s. There was a project called Jobs with Peace in the 80s, which wasn't entirely a black outfit, but there was a lot of organizing in inner city neighborhoods on a very serious level. There was a group called the Gulf Tenants, Gulf of Mexico, who were public housing tenants who waged a campaign in the 80s to cut $10 billion out of the federal budget and every year federal military budget and used to build public housing. So there's a long legacy of folks trying to substantially cut military spending and use it for high priority jobs and human needs here at home. But Barney's was a good launch point in a moment when it was clear that the party was over. This is around the time that Wall Street crashed the economy. Mm-hmm. Deficits became an issue, although we think that they are kind of a bogus and distracting issue as far as we're concerned. Right. Because it sets up an austerity program, and we're more interested in expanding spending on what we need as a way of getting prosperity in the economy going. So a group of people across the country independently reached the conclusion that if there's ever a moment to cut military spending substantially, now is it, because there can't be both guns and butter. One or the other is going to get cut. We have to make a choice. Now's the time to put that choice on the front burner and keep hammering away at it and force our political so-called representatives to make a choice. So that's what we've done in Boston and around the country over the last 3 or 4 years, is to set up a campaign that's about making that choice. It says, you know, we have to do one or the other. It's clear. And the city council resolutions we were talking about earlier, for example, are an attempt to enlist local elected officials in that push. Mm-hmm. We want to turn them into our lobbyists. Along with us, pushed by us, to go to Congress and say, you know, take that money and turn it around. Some other things that we're doing are basically joining social justice movements like yesterday's march on tax justice. That, particularly in Boston, that's been our strategy, because we don't think that the peace movement alone can win this demand. It's got to be driven by the people that need the jobs and need the services the most, and that's people of color, it's working class people, it's working class organizations, racial justice organizations. So in Boston, there's a coalition to cut military spending, fund our communities,
which works on both taxes and cutting the military budget.
I mean, basically, we have a four-point program, which is create jobs, save services, tax the rich and corporations, cut the Pentagon, and end the wars. So that coalition is composed of organizations of color, like Boston Workers Alliance, New England United for Justice, Chinese Progressive Association, and they are the ones articulating the demand to move the money to our communities.
I mean, there's a very logical connection between the military budget and taxation, because it's, if nothing else, it's a question of what's our tax money being spent on. That's actually, I'm getting a little off topic, but that's another way that many people have traditionally protested the military budget, is through tax resistance, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And the connection's especially acute now. There's a lot of movement for making corporations pay up, the tax-dodging corporations, making the 1% pay up, increasing the capital gains tax, financial transaction tax, all kinds of very good ideas that would bring more money into public coffers for the services we need, and also cut down the power of all those foreign-named entities, real people and corporate people. But it doesn't do a lot of good to increase their taxes if the money's going to be eaten up by the Pentagon and wars. We have to take on the issue of how the government is spending our money, not just whether it's taxing or not, and not cede that issue to the right. And that's really something that kind of the left, liberals, and everyone in between have not done enough of, I think, in these past years. The Pentagon, or military spending in general, is the case study of what's wrong with government at the federal level. It's the prime example of corruption, of kind of a funding cycle, of money being spent, misspent in ways that are destructive to us. And the problem with the permanent war economy that we have is that it's steadily eating away not just at our economic well-being, but our freedom. If you look at the militarization of police departments by training them in military tactics and, you know, pushing military hardware on
them. A lot of which is being pushed by some of the same military contractors who are selling the weapons system to the Pentagon. They'd be very happy to sell high-tech armaments to the police as well.
High-tech stuff, drones coming in.
Yeah.
Armored vehicles. I mean, why does a police department need an armored vehicle? You know, there aren't that many hostage taking cases, or you know, and the erosion.
Well,
of
maybe if we look at the West Bank, we can maybe see what they think they're going to use them for.
Yeah, there's a real.
maybe the example we should be looking to.
Well, yeah, if you look at how they're behaving, you get some pretty apocalyptic ideas about the kinds of forces we're going to be dealing with and the kinds of firepower advantages they're going to have in the future. But there are also huge attacks on basic freedoms and civil liberties in things like the NATO summit that's about to happen in Chicago. Rahm Emanuel, Obama's former right-hand man, mm-hmm. is basically, you know, suspending freedom in the center city of Chicago and not allowing people to assemble.
They have a long tradition of that in Chicago.
Yes, they do. He's not the first. If you look at the National Defense Authorization Act, there was an enormous kind of blow to the right to life, basically, you know, giving the president the right to assassinate U.S. citizens. So these things all come not just directly from military spending, but from the wars and, you know, fear campaigns that justify ongoing military spending. So the military-industrial congressional complex has an impact throughout our lives, not just on our economic survival, but on kind of our freedom to demand change and win it.
Our basic civil liberties. I mean, the whole buildup of covert observation and intelligence mm-hmm. gathering domestically mm-hmm. that seems to be taking place. I mean, who knows what kind of information they're tracking right now.
Well, yeah. So we're really looking at a choice in a lot of ways. It's either the Pentagon or us.
Mm-hmm. You talked about working with community groups and working, you know, the focus on taxes and things like that. We talked about what about working with the more traditional peace community? I mean, because it seems to me that if you want to have a hope of cutting the military budget, you have to try to also try to avoid us getting involved in even further wars. I mean, if we go to war with Iran, you know, it's going to be very hard to convince anybody to cut the military budget.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. We have to push back on that. At the same time, the peace movement has been going through cycles since I've been alive of stopping this war, and then this war, and then this war, or lobbying against this weapon system and this weapon system and this weapon system. And we need to do that because the wars justify the spending.
Right.
So the peace movement has an enormous contribution to make mm-hmm. toward a broader movement to cut military spending so that we can move the money to our communities. Mm-hmm. But it also has to do a better job of that than it's been able to do in the past. And we have
to... But they've been fighting an uphill battle. You have to...
it is an uphill battle. But the peace movement, in my view, is much too siloed, much too isolated. Uh-huh. You know, talks, deals, you know, more with itself than it ought to be doing. And mm-hmm. I think a broader movement building strategy that has cutting military spending and ending wars as part of its agenda mm-hmm. is a better strategy than to sort of, you know, steadfastly hold on to a separate peace movement. And that's basically what we're trying to do. We're a coalition building mm-hmm. initiative. We believe in, you know, developing the relationships over time, the trust, you know, the working relationships to be able to achieve a broader agenda of which we are a part. And that's particularly been our strategy in Boston, mm-hmm. but it's others are doing that around the country mm-hmm. as well.
So maybe you could tell me a little more about what you do to try to reach out beyond sort of the usual suspects and spread the word out further. Because obviously you're going to have to build something more like a mass base in order to do this. I mean, that's you talked about the peace movement being siloed. I mean, it's it's an accusation that often is leveled with some justice at those of us on the left, that we spend all our time preaching to the choir and we never really do talk to the masses of the people, if you will. So how are you trying to get around that? Obviously working with civil, with city governments and things as an example, but how are you?
Well, at the national level, what we're doing is working with organizations like U.S. Action or Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, which are, you know, economic justice and racial justice networks and organizations, and trying to basically support what they're doing, come up with campaigns or circulate initiatives that they launch. So we're trying not just to be about wars and not just be about military spending either, although that's kind of our piece to hold up. At the local level, it's different in every city, but in Boston, the starting point is that this is a very organized city. There is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of youth organizing, there's a lot of community organizing, there's quite a bit of labor organizing, there's issue organizing of different sorts, environmental organizing out the ears. So you're not walking into a vacuum. And our approach has been to build relationships, particularly in Dorchester and Roxbury, I'm from Dorchester, with organizations on the ground working for mainly economic justice, to support their actions, to go to their actions, to, you know, show up, to, you know, learn what they're about, not to ask them to get onto our bus, but to you know, kind of support their bus. And you know, this takes years, but you do build up trust, working relationships that allow amazing things to happen. And people start to incorporate, you know, your perspective into theirs if it's logical, if it really fits, not because you're there, you know, being nice or showing up, although that's an indispensable part of, of it. But, I mean, people have to be able to trust you. They have to know who you are. They have to be able to work with you. And that takes time. It doesn't, it's not just, hey, we're forming a coalition, you want to join it, or let's do an action. But also, the connection has to be logical.
I mean, you're, the issue does connect with almost anybody's issue, because no matter what you're lobbying for, no matter what a group is working for, it's going to take money for them to achieve their goals in almost every case. And basically what you're saying is we have an idea how you can get some money. So it seems like that it's always going to be, it's almost, like, it's hard to imagine an issue that that doesn't make a good fit with.
And what we're saying is we can be a part of your solution. Not we are the answer. But I think maybe I should spend a little time talking about how this developed in Dorchester specifically, because I think there might be some lessons for Occupy in
it. Sounds good.
So there's a group called Dorchester People for Peace that I belong to that started about 10 years ago before the Iraq War started. And the people in it were fairly experienced, and we had a lot of great advice from black activists who were had a much deeper political experience than the rest of us. And it was obvious from the start that if we wanted to get a peace organization, a peace movement going on in Dorchester, it wasn't going to be a traditional peace movement. It had to be about community issues. It had to be, not exclusively, it had to be a peace organization, of course, but it had to be about violence in the streets, about economic injustice, about racial injustice, about political, racial profiling, and so forth. So, great idea. How do you operationalize it? You know, how do you actually carry this out? It, we took a couple of years doing anti-racist training, developing a practice, promoting the leadership of people of color, you know, getting to know other organizations in the neighborhood, many of which we had connections with already. But the solution walked in one day in a meeting when one of our members came in saying, "Hey, my son's in high school, and the high school is sending his name to the Pentagon so that they can call my house, every week and try to recruit him." Under No Child Left Behind, every publicly funded, every federally funded high school has to send its student list to the Pentagon every year, so that military recruiters can call it.
I didn't know that. That's
astounding.
That's astounding.
And But when that passed Congress, someone put in a clause that's saying, but you can opt out. You, the student or the parent, can take your name off the list. Uh-huh. So we said, okay. We looked into it. We printed up leaflets and postcards, and the postcards were addressed to the school department, and they said, take my name off the list or take my child's name off the list. Hmm. So we started taking them around to community organizations, you know, to the Y, to the health centers, to, you know, more activist and community organizing outfits. And, you know, the person at the desk would say, what? I didn't know about that. That's outrageous. Give me some of those. So over the course of a few years, we built up relationships with 70 different community organizations. Wow. And some of the youth organizing projects, and youth organizing is really an industry in Boston, mm-hmm. picked it up as leadership development training, particularly Project Hip Hop and a group at St. Stephen's Church. Mm-hmm. So that's the way we really got to know and work closely with a broad range of organizations on an issue where our interests overlapped. Hmm. But it also involved basically an anti-racist approach, which is to, you know, pull back, you know, let other people take the lead, subordinate your agenda, or at least, you know, cool it on your agenda and hear what other people are doing before you push it. Mm-hmm. And that's, if you don't do that, it's going to be very difficult to develop the kinds of working relationships that you'll need for ongoing coalition work. It's, mm-hmm. You're not going to get it by kind of leading with your agenda and, you know, imagining that you're kind of the dynamizing force. Because mm-hmm. there are a lot of people who have been at this a lot longer than we have, mm-hmm. And they have done really hard work to build up a base under much more unfavorable circumstances. Mm-hmm. Less resources, skills deficits, definitely kind of an influence and connection deficit. Mm-hmm. So if I had any advice, it would be sort of, you know, learn sort of like anti-racist organizing methods. There are great groups like the Catalyst Project out in the Bay Area that do trainings, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, look around and get to know the territory that's already being organized and work with it. Mm-hmm. That's what worked for us, at least.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I wanted to ask you about briefly is if you've done any work or any strategizing around how to cut the budget, because it seems that maybe not all military budget cuts are alike, and yep. Maybe some things are better to cut than others, and
I certainly think so. So I should have said this at the beginning, but our starting point is, don't cut veterans' benefits. Don't cut medical care for veterans. Mm-hmm. You know, don't undermine people that are in uniform. You know, if they're on the front line, they have to have whatever they need to survive. Obviously, the best strategy is to get them the hell out of there, mm-hmm. and to, you know, end these wars that are, you know, only chewing them up and making the world more unsafe for everybody, including us. But, you know, you don't undercut, you know, people that are at risk, whether they are retired military or current military. Mm-hmm. So what I think we should cut is power projection. The reason that the U.S. military budget is so high is that it's trying to cover the entire world.
I see.
With 5% of the population.
I didn't know what you meant by power projection.
So, close most of those foreign military bases. Mm-hmm. People don't want us there anyway. Mm-hmm. There are over 200 of them in Germany. You know, last I checked, World War II had been over for how many years? 60 years. They're building a new base in Guam that people there don't want, on Jeju Island in South Korea that people don't want.
I thought they managed to stop Jeju Island. Is that,
No. Okinawa is... They're closing one base but expanding another. Now, Jeju Island, last I heard, was roaring forward, dynamiting pristine reefs, everything else. Yeah, it's a crime. Cut carrier battle groups. We don't need 11 carrier battle groups. They're not defensive.
No.
They are exactly the opposite. Cut the Air Force, cut the Navy down to what would actually be needed to defend people, not corporations, in this country. Uh-huh. we don't need to be controlling the sea lanes off China.
Right.
Which is the current encircle China strategy. We don't need to have a missile system ringing China to that, you know, could acquire the capability to shoot down Chinese missiles, in which case a first strike, a nuclear first strike, becomes possible.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, there's some, you know, these people are nuts who are trying to, you know, basically make up for declining United States economic power by military means and bully the rest of the world into going along with it. And we could, we people, not corporations in the United States, would be much better off if that money were not being spent, if all those arms programs and those power projection programs were stopped, and if the U.S. military were returned to defense, you know, to what, you know, it's called the Defense Department. Let's make right. it that way.
Used to be called the War Department.
Yes.
Once upon a time.
Before World War II. There's a really interesting story, I mean, just to illustrate the radical change of the last, of our lifetimes. The Pentagon, which is an enormous building, is entirely accessible, wheelchair accessible. Hmm. That's because at the point that they built it to direct World War II for the whole bureaucracy, they couldn't imagine that it would be needed for that purpose after the war. The U.S. had always shrunk its military back after each war. So they designed it as a hospital.
Wow.
To be converted into a hospital.
That's amazing. I didn't know that story.
Yeah. And, you know, and here's a quote from the head of General Electric, Charles Wilson, at the end of World War II. The revulsion against war, not too long hence, i.e. when, you know, the war ends, will be an almost insuperable obstacle for us to overcome. He's speaking as a military contractor. And for that reason, I am convinced that we must begin now to set the machinery in motion for a permanent war economy.
Hmm.
So, you know, the Cold War...
This wasn't an accident, is what you're saying.
No, it was done
We didn't just stumble into it.
No, it was done for kind of... dominate the world for corporations' purposes, done for, you know, fear purposes to...
I mean, that quote you read almost makes it sound more like it's not even dominating the world for corporate purposes so much as dominate the world so that we have a market for our defense products.
Well, yeah, and we haven't talked about exporting arms, but that is a major objective of the U.S. arms procurement right. policy. So... It, you know, yes, it's a setup.
I mean, given that power block and that trinity you were talking about before, you know, Congress and military officers and the military contractors, isn't cutting the military budget, as hard as it is, actually the easier problem, and cutting it in the ways that it should be cut, actually even harder? It seems like if you force them to make cuts, they're going to say, oh, okay, we'll cut, you know, armor for, you know,
well, actually, what they're trying to cut first is personnel and benefits. They're acting like any corporation, any of Romney's, you know, acquired corporations,
right.
they're downsizing and or right-sizing, they would probably say. And they're trying to cut medical care and benefits to military personnel and retirees. So they're acting just like any other corporation in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the other challenge is to cut military spending and move the money to our communities instead of cutting military spending and using it to reduce the deficit or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any? Do you work at all with veterans groups and with military groups? I mean, it sounds
well.
Like
Iraq Veterans Against the War, mm-hmm. Veterans for Peace. Mm-hmm. Yes, we mm-hmm. do. Military Families Speak Out. Those are all members of the New Priorities Network nationally.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of running out of questions, but it seems like
I have plenty more answers.
Maybe you should give me an answer, and I'll try to think of a question for.
Well,
I mean, it's kind of. I think my mind at this point is kind of. I'm feeling a little overwhelmed.
Well,
frankly.
We've been jumping around, but it is overwhelming, and it's there are so many like the deeper you get into it, the more outrageous it is. But let's talk a bit about the congressional leg of the Iron Triangle, okay. The military-industrial congressional complex, because really the piece of it that we're going to hear a lot of this year, it being a presidential election year, is the tougher on defense, no, I'm tougher on defense, no, I'm tougher on defense game, mm-hmm. Which always goes on between the two major, you know, parties. John Kennedy was partly elected president because he invented a fictitious missile gap with the Soviet Union and accused the Republicans of letting the country down. So he was trying to outright wing Richard Nixon and the Republican Party on defense. And Democratic,
of course, our country has moved so much more to the right than Dick Nixon at this phase. That
that's true, but the game, you know, the game goes on, yeah. And Democrats always have to show that they're tougher on military matters than Republicans. So that's going to happen this year. It's going to happen explicitly about levels of military spending because Romney has made that an issue, and it's going to happen about, you know, wars and, you know, kind of other forms of aggression, and it's enormously destructive because it sets a tone about, you know, basically fear, terror, being armed to the teeth. That's the political dynamic in this country. And that's an essential part of the Iron Triangle that keeps funding the military, keeps funding weapon systems, keeps overfunding all of these programs. So we also have to go over after that. Mm-hmm. Until we take that down, it's going to be very difficult to, you know, someone is always going to be able to revive it, just the same way as someone is always going to be able to start another war that gins up fear and rallying around the flag.
It seems like maybe again in Boston and as a person of the left, maybe I'm too isolated from the rest of the world, but it just seems like there's enough understanding now, enough knowledge that the U.S. military budget is so huge compared to the rest of the world. You'd think that those kind of arguments would start to not resonate with the voters, but apparently they still do.
It depends on how you phrase it, and the polls reflect this. You get very different poll results. The poll results are really positive from my point of view. If you ask, should we cut Social Security or the military? People will cut the military. Before it's that, about, yeah. You know, 4-1. Yeah. It's a stunning figure.
If you give them that stark choice.
Yeah, and that is the choice. So that's the point that we're trying to raise. Is mm-hmm. Yes, that is the choice, and mm-hmm. you have to decide, and you have to tell, you know, officials of all sorts that that's what you want. But if you ask, you know, would you rather be defenseless or defended, then you get a different result. So yeah. It's by raising fears and, you know, starting wars that they manage to perpetuate this. Right. So we
and
basically...
People don't make the connections. They don't connect the question they were asked yesterday with the question they're being asked today.
In some ways,
or too often they don't.
In some ways, yeah. So, you know, what we need really is a movement capable of putting that choice on the table and keeping it on the table, keeping that being the choice that people are opting for.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a pretty good place to end, since I do have a few announcements that I have to read at the end of the show. But we've been listening to the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. We've been talking with activist Mike Prokosh about peace and economic justice. Well, that is it for our rebroadcast of our program that originally aired on April 18th, 2012, about the military budget. The Free School University program is educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. Please join us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. USA Eastern Time on Occupy Boston Radio, obr.fm on your internet browser. And don't forget to check out our blog at fsuradio.wordpress.com. That's fsuradio.wordpress.com. We have program information and archival recordings, and you can also connect to our podcast feed there. That's it. Hope you enjoyed the show, and good night.